The consolation of philosophy has been a cornerstone of Western thought for 15 centuries, yet few modern readers know its remarkable origin story. Written by a man awaiting execution in a prison cell without access to books, this masterpiece emerged from the darkest moment of its author's life. Boethius, statesman, scholar, and philosopher, composed this dialogue between himself and Lady Philosophy while facing a death sentence on trumped-up charges of treason. The work has influenced countless luminaries through history, from King Alfred and Chaucer to C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Elizabeth I reportedly translated it in 24 hours during her own political troubles. As W.P. Kerr noted, it saved the thought of the Middle Ages by preserving classical wisdom during Europe's darkest hours. Even today, its exploration of fortune, happiness, and the nature of evil remains startlingly relevant to anyone facing life's inevitable setbacks and searching for meaning beyond material success. Anicius Manlius Severinus Boethius embodied the ideal of the philosopher ruler when he entered the service of Theodoric the Ostrogoth in early 6th century Italy. Born into a distinguished Roman Christian family around 480 CE, Boethius had devoted his early life to an ambitious project of translating and preserving Greek philosophical works, particularly those of Aristotle and Plato. His masterful translations and commentaries would later become the primary source through which medieval scholars accessed classical philosophy. His brilliance and noble lineage earned him the prestigious position of Master of Offices in Theodoric's government, where he initially thrived opposing corruption and defending justice while simultaneously pursuing his scholarly endeavors. The political landscape of 6th century Italy was complex and treacherous. Theodoric's Ostrogothic kingdom represented a delicate balance between Roman traditions and Germanic rule, between Eastern and Western interests, and between Arian and Catholic Christianity. The healing of the Acacian Schism between Eastern and Western churches in 519 CE created dangerous political tensions that would ultimately contribute to Boethius's downfall. Theodoric, an Arian Christian ruling a predominantly Catholic population, grew increasingly paranoid about potential conspiracies with Constantinople, fearing that prominent Roman nobles might ally with the Eastern Empire to restore direct Byzantine rule. The crisis came to a head when letters from Senator Albinus to the Eastern Emperor Justin I were intercepted. Though their content was likely innocuous, in the paranoid atmosphere of the time, they were interpreted as evidence of treason. Boethius, demonstrating the moral courage that had characterized his career, boldly defended his colleague against these accusations. This act of loyalty proved fatal. He soon found himself implicated in the same charges, with additional accusations of sorcery and sacrilege added to ensure his downfall. His enemies, including the ambitious official Cyprian, produced false witnesses and forged documents to seal his fate. The subsequent trial was a mockery of justice that betrayed everything Boethius had worked for in public service. Without being permitted to face his accusers or present a proper defense, he was condemned by a servile Senate, stripped of his extensive property, and imprisoned in Pavia's Tower. There, after suffering various forms of torture, he awaited execution by the particularly brutal method of clubbing, where a rope would be tied around his head and gradually tightened until his skull cracked. It was during these dark days of imprisonment with death looming that he composed his masterpiece, The Consolation of Philosophy. What makes this context so remarkable is the complete absence of bitterness or self-pity in the work. Instead of penning an angry defense or seeking revenge through words, Boethius created a timeless meditation on fortune, happiness, and the divine order. His personal catastrophe became the catalyst for a work that would guide countless readers, from medieval monks to Renaissance scholars to modern philosophers, through their own moments of despair across 15 centuries. The work's enduring influence stands as testament to how Boethius transformed his personal tragedy into universal wisdom, creating what would become one of the most influential philosophical works in Western history. The consolation unfolds as a dialogue between Boethius the prisoner and philosophy, personified as a majestic woman of awe-inspiring presence. She appears to him as a tall, dignified figure whose age is impossible to determine, wearing a dress of imperishable fabric adorned with the Greek letters pi and theta, symbolizing practical and theoretical wisdom. Finding him wallowing in self-pity, attended by the poetic muses who encourage his lamentations, philosophy dismisses these hysterical sluts who offer only sweetened poisons rather than true medicine for his condition. This dramatic opening establishes the work's fundamental premise. Emotional catharsis without rational understanding merely deepens despair rather than healing it. What follows is a masterful fusion of literary forms. The work alternates between prose dialogue and 39 metrical poems in various classical forms, a style known as Menippean satire. These poems employ diverse meters, including elegiac couplets, sapphic stanzas, and anapestic dimeters, each chosen to complement its subject matter. The poems serve multiple functions, providing aesthetic relief from dense philosophical arguments, summarizing key points for better retention, and offering emotional perspective like a Greek chorus commenting on the action. The magnificent ninth poem of Book 3, celebrating divine governance through cosmic imagery and mathematical harmony, stands as perhaps the finest example of Boethius's poetic skill, weaving together Platonic, Pythagorean, and Christian themes. The overall structure follows a Platonic framework of the soul's ascent from falsehood to truth, organized in five books that progressively build upon each other. Book 1 establishes the prisoner's situation and begins his therapy. Book 2 addresses the nature of fortune. Book 3 examines true happiness. Book 4 tackles divine providence and evil. And Book 5 culminates in an exploration of free will and eternity. We begin with Boethius at his lowest point, confused, despairing, and fixated on external goods. Through philosophy's careful questioning and instruction, using the Socratic method, he gradually recovers his understanding of true happiness and the divine order. This progression mirrors Plato's allegory of prisoners escaping the cave of illusion to perceive reality in the sunlight of truth. What makes this structure particularly effective is how it operates simultaneously on multiple levels. On the personal level, it traces Boethius's journey from despair to consolation, offering practical wisdom for dealing with misfortune. Philosophically, it moves from basic ethical questions about fortune and happiness to profound metaphysical explorations of providence and eternity, engaging with both Platonic and Aristotelian traditions. Spiritually, it depicts the soul's ascent from material attachments to contemplation of the divine, incorporating Neoplatonic concepts of emanation and return. This multi-layered architecture allows readers at different stages of intellectual and spiritual development to find meaning appropriate to their needs, while the alternation between prose and verse provides both intellectual rigor and emotional resonance. The consolation begins with Boethius lamenting his dramatic reversal of fortune, from respected statesman to condemned prisoner. Philosophy's first task is to address this fixation on fortune's fickleness, which she does by personifying fortune herself. "I would argue my case with you in fortune's own words," philosophy declares. "Why do you attack me with daily complaints? What harm have I done you? What possessions of yours have I taken away?" This personification of fortune as a capricious goddess with her ever-turning wheel became one of the most influential images in medieval literature and art. Fortune explains that inconstancy is her very essence. To remain constant would violate her nature. Those who rise must eventually fall. Those who fall may rise again. The only certainty is change itself. "You have entrusted your happiness to powers that are not your own," philosophy explains. "Do you really value wind so much? Don't you realize that if they stopped blowing, they would cease to be what you value?" The metaphor extends beyond mere chance to encompass all external goods, wealth, power, fame, pleasure that humans mistakenly identify with happiness. Like the skilled physician diagnosing an illness, philosophy demonstrates how each of these apparent goods fails to deliver what it promises. Wealth creates more wants than it satisfies. The wealthy person needs guards, servants, and storage for possessions, becoming enslaved to what they supposedly own. Power proves illusory when we examine it closely. Even kings depend on their servants' loyalty and live in constant fear of assassination. As philosophy wryly notes, what kind of power is it that cannot remove the gnawing of anxiety or avoid the thorns of fear? Fame extends only to a tiny portion of the earth for a fleeting moment in time's vastness. The fame of any man will not extend to all people any more than it will last forever. Physical pleasures bring anxiety in their pursuit and remorse in their aftermath, often leading to illness and pain. How many bitter things are mixed with the sweetness of bodily pleasure? How much sickness follows its enjoyment? Through this systematic deconstruction, philosophy helps Boethius see that his attachment to fortune's gifts was the very source of his suffering. By placing his happiness in things beyond his control, he made himself vulnerable to fortune's inevitable changes. The remedy lies not in regaining what was lost, but in recognizing that true happiness was never found in these external goods to begin with. Having dismantled false conceptions of happiness, philosophy leads Boethius toward understanding true happiness. She begins with a profound observation about human nature. All people desire happiness, but most seek it in fragmented, contradictory ways. All mortals share a single desire, to achieve happiness, philosophy explains. But they pursue this through different paths, some seeking wealth to have no wants, others pursuing respect through positions of honor, some desiring power to rule or be close to rulers, while others chase fame or pleasure. The brilliance of Boethius's analysis lies in showing how these fragmented pursuits actually undermine themselves. Those who pursue wealth sacrifice power and pleasure. Those chasing power expend wealth and despise pleasures. Each exclusive pursuit prevents obtaining even the single quality desired, because these goods are interconnected aspects of a unified whole. Through Socratic questioning, philosophy leads Boethius to recognize that what people truly seek in these partial goods are five interconnected qualities: self-sufficiency, freedom from want, power, ability to accomplish one's will, respect, recognition from others, fame, enduring reputation, and joy, pleasure without regret. These five qualities aren't separate goods, but aspects of a single perfect good. When these qualities are sought separately, they cannot deliver what they promise, philosophy explains. Only when united in a single perfect good can they provide what all humans seek. This perfect good, she demonstrates through logical reasoning, must be identical with God himself. Just as various streams flow from a single spring, all partial goods derive from the supreme good. True happiness, therefore, consists in possessing this supreme good, which means possessing God through contemplation and moral alignment with divine goodness. This insight transforms Boethius's understanding of his situation. If true happiness lies in the possession of an unchangeable good that cannot be taken away, then his external circumstances, however painful, cannot touch his essential happiness. The path to this happiness lies not in regaining lost fortune, but in turning the mind toward contemplation of the unchanging divine order. Having established that true happiness consists in possessing the supreme good, God, Boethius raises the central question that has troubled philosophers and theologians throughout history. How can evil exist in a world governed by an omniscient, omnipotent God who wills only good? This question takes on particular urgency for Boethius, who faces execution despite his innocence. If God rules the world with justice, why do good people suffer while the wicked prosper? Philosophy addresses this challenge through a series of increasingly profound arguments. First, she establishes that the wicked are fundamentally powerless despite appearances. The wicked achieve none of what they actually desire, she explains. They seek happiness but move further from it through evil deeds. Like a person walking in the wrong direction, the more energy they expend, the farther they get from their destination. Moreover, the wicked suffer an internal punishment worse than any external penalty, the corruption of their own nature. Just as goodness is its own reward, wickedness is its own punishment. By turning away from goodness, the wicked cease to exist as they once were, losing their human nature and sinking to the level of animals. The violent become wolf-like, the contentious dog-like, the ambusher fox-like, and the lustful like swine. But this still doesn't explain why the externally wicked prosper while good people suffer. Here, philosophy introduces a crucial distinction between providence and fate. Providence is God's simple, unchanging plan, viewing all things simultaneously from eternity. Fate is this same plan as it unfolds through time, appearing to humanize as a complex chain of causes and effects. What seems confused and disordered to you appears perfectly arranged when viewed from Providence's perspective, philosophy explains. Just as a circle appears different when viewed from its center versus its circumference, events that seem chaotic in time are perfectly ordered in eternity. From this perspective, what appears as bad fortune for good people serves a purpose within the divine plan, either strengthening virtue through adversity, preventing good people from being corrupted by prosperity, or setting an example for others. Similarly, prosperity given to the wicked may serve as a test, revealing their true nature, or as an opportunity for redemption. This explanation culminates in philosophy's striking claim that all fortune is good fortune when properly understood. Pleasant fortune rewards and tests the good, adverse fortune disciplines and strengthens them. For the wicked, punishment offers correction, while prosperity reveals their unworthiness. In God's economy, nothing is wasted. Even apparent evil serves the ultimate good. As the dialogue approaches its conclusion, Boethius raises the most perplexing philosophical problem of all. How can human free will exist if God foreknows all actions? If God already knows what I will choose tomorrow, how can my choice be truly free? If God foresees all things and cannot be mistaken, Boethius argues, then what Providence has foreseen will happen must happen. If from eternity Providence foreknows not only human actions but also plans and wishes, there can be no freedom of will. This apparent contradiction between divine foreknowledge and human freedom has troubled thinkers for centuries. Boethius presents the problem with exceptional clarity through the analogy of a sitting man. If you see someone sitting, your knowledge that he sits must be true. Conversely, if your knowledge that he sits is true, he must be sitting. In both cases, necessity exists. Similarly, if God foreknows an action, that action must necessarily occur. Philosophy's response represents one of the most influential solutions in the history of Western thought. She begins by challenging Boethius's fundamental assumption that foreknowledge imposes necessity. Knowledge, she explains, depends on the knower's capacity rather than the object known. Different beings know the same thing in different ways, according to their nature. A cow is perceived differently by sight, touch, imagination, reason, and divine intelligence, yet remains the same cow. The crucial insight comes with philosophy's definition of eternity, not as infinite duration, but as complete, simultaneous, and perfect possession of everlasting life. God exists in an eternal present where past and future are simultaneously visible. From this timeless perspective, God sees our future choices not as predetermined, but as they actually occur in their own time. Just as you're seeing someone walk doesn't force them to walk, philosophy explains, God's foreseeing our actions doesn't compel them. He sees them as contingent events occurring through free choice. This elegant solution preserves both divine omniscience and human freedom. God knows our choices because he sees them happening in his eternal present, not because he causes them to happen. Our choices remain free even though God knows what we will choose. The consolation concludes not with abstract theory, but with profound practical moral guidance. Having established that God governs the world with perfect justice and sees all actions from the perspective of eternity, philosophy draws the essential ethical conclusion. Since you act under the eyes of a judge who sees all things, you should live virtuously. This divine oversight implies not a crushing surveillance, but rather an invitation to align ourselves with cosmic order. This practical dimension reveals the true purpose of Boethius's philosophical journey. The consolation isn't merely an intellectual exercise, but a form of spiritual medicine, what ancient philosophers called therapia, treatment for the soul. Through rational understanding and systematic contemplation, Boethius finds not just theoretical satisfaction, but genuine consolation in the face of death. His work demonstrates how philosophy can serve as both compass and comfort in life's darkest moments. Several practical principles emerge from this transformative journey. First, external fortune, whether good or bad, should be met with equanimity. The wise person neither exults in prosperity nor despairs in adversity, recognizing that true happiness lies beyond fortune's reach. When wealth comes, it should be held lightly. When it departs, one should remember its temporary nature. This principle manifests in practical detachment from material success and resilience in the face of loss. Second, apparent evils often serve hidden goods. Adversity tests and strengthens virtue, while prosperity can corrupt and weaken character. As philosophy notes, adverse fortune often draws men back to their true good like a shepherdess with her crook. Illness may teach patience, loss may reveal true friends, and failure may redirect us to more meaningful pursuits. Even imprisonment, as in Boethius's case, can become an opportunity for profound spiritual growth. Third, human freedom carries profound responsibility. Since we act under the gaze of an all-seeing judge, we should align our choices with the good. Our actions matter precisely because they are freely chosen, not predetermined. This freedom requires careful deliberation and moral courage, as each decision shapes not only our circumstances, but our character. Fourth, contemplation of the divine order provides a secure refuge from life's uncertainties. By turning the mind toward unchanging truth, we participate in what cannot be taken away even by death. This contemplative practice involves regular philosophical reflection, meditation on eternal principles, and the cultivation of inner stillness. These principles transformed Boethius's prison cell into a school of wisdom. Through sustained philosophical reflection, he transcended his immediate circumstances to glimpse an eternal perspective. His personal transformation demonstrates how philosophical understanding can elevate the mind above temporal suffering. As he writes in the magnificent conclusion to Book 3, "Here is the source of peace, the secure harbor, the only open refuge for the wretched, to know that all the bonds of earthly fortune are loosened." The lasting impact of Boethius's practical wisdom lies in its applicability across centuries and cultures. His insights continue to offer guidance for navigating life's challenges, from personal setbacks to existential questions. The consolation shows that philosophical wisdom, properly understood and applied, can transform even the most difficult circumstances into opportunities for spiritual growth and moral development. The consolation's influence extends far beyond Boethius's time, becoming what historian Henry Chadwick called the most widely read non-religious work of the Middle Ages. Its impact manifested in three distinct but interconnected spheres: philosophical, literary, and spiritual. Philosophically, Boethius preserved crucial elements of classical thought that might otherwise have been lost during Europe's tumultuous early medieval period. His definitions of eternity, free will, and divine foreknowledge became foundational for medieval scholasticism. Thomas Aquinas cited him extensively, and the great schoolmen relied on his logical framework for addressing theological questions. Literarily, the Consolation inspired countless imitations and translations. King Alfred rendered it into Old English. Chaucer translated it into Middle English. Queen Elizabeth I reportedly translated it during her own political troubles. Its alternating prose and verse structure influenced medieval literature, while its personification of philosophy inspired allegorical figures in works from Dante's Divine Comedy to Spenser's Faery Queen. Spiritually, the Consolation offered a bridge between classical philosophy and Christian faith. Though explicitly Christian doctrine is absent from the text, leading some scholars to question Boethius's Christianity, medieval readers recognized its compatibility with Christian teaching. The work provided a rational foundation for faith, demonstrating how philosophical inquiry could support rather than undermine religious belief. What explains this enduring appeal across such diverse audiences? Perhaps it lies in the Consolation's unique position at the intersection of personal experience and universal truth. Boethius wrote not as a detached theorist, but as a man facing death, seeking meaning in suffering. His journey from despair to understanding mirrors the human condition itself. We all face fortune's reversals and seek consolation beyond material circumstances. In our own age of anxiety, where external success often masks inner emptiness, Boethius's message remains profoundly relevant. His distinction between false and true happiness speaks directly to our culture's confusion about what constitutes a good life. His analysis of fortune's wheel resonates in a world of economic volatility and rapid social change. Above all, his vision of a rational order behind apparent chaos offers hope that our suffering isn't meaningless, even when we cannot fully comprehend its purpose. The Consolation reminds us that philosophy isn't merely an academic exercise, but a practical resource for living well amid life's uncertainties. As Boethius discovered in his prison cell, reason can indeed console when fortune fails.